صلوات. We're going to have Brother Ahmed read some Quran for us tonight. Go ahead, Brother Ahmed.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والتين والزيتون وطور سينين وهذا البلد الأمين لقد خلقنا الإنسان في أحسن تقويم ثم لدنا ثم أسفل سافلين إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات فلهم أجر خير أبنون فما يكذبك بعد بالدين أليس الله بأحكم الحاكمين صدق الله العلي العظيم. By the fig and the olive, by the Mount Sinai, by this secure town, we certainly created man in the best of forms. Then we relegated him to the lowest of the low, except those who have faith in the righteous deeds. There will be an everlasting reward for them. So what makes you deny retribution is not Allah the fairest of all judges.
MashaAllah. Okay, in the interest of time, I'd like to invite Maulana to start the majlis. If you brothers could all move forward, please. Salawat.
سورة الفاتحة. حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. There are two things that make every difficult job easy and every challenging task simple in life, and these two tools we have. So anything we might think is hard or difficult would become easy if these two tools are applied in ourselves. The first tool is culture. The second tool is perception. If I told you to go out and buy a dress that is extremely expensive and very uncomfortable, and you will only wear it for one day and throw it away, would you imagine yourself doing that? Right? That you would buy a $5,000 dress, you'd only wear it once, it's very uncomfortable, and you throw it away. Right? It would be hard for us to imagine that we would do such a thing. Even when you go out buying, shopping, we'll see, okay, you know what? Is it comfortable? Is it useful? And is it affordable? But if you go and buy a dress that's extremely expensive, $5,000, or more, and you only wear it once and you'll throw it away after that, you would find yourself very hard to do such a thing. I mean, you know, it would be unimaginable for us to buy such a dress. But we do it all the times in our wedding, right? We go out in our wedding, we buy a dress that's extremely expensive and extremely uncomfortable, right? And you only wear it once and you'll never wear it again. And you do that. And it's very easy for you to do that, and you do it with a lot of excitement also. The reason that you do such a thing is because it is a part of our culture. It's a part of our culture. Our culture makes things that are seemingly difficult easy for us to do. Our culture makes things that are challenging very simple for us to do, if we make those things a part of our culture. Another example I can give you is that, you know, would you send your child to someone else's house, not knowing whether he's a pervert, child molester, or any of these things? I mean, we wouldn't imagine ourselves doing that. People won't do that. In fact, they would try to protect them from going to a stranger's house or a stranger's home. But we see that people do it all the time in Halloween. Right? They send their children off to a stranger's home, not knowing whether that person they're going to, what kind of a person he is. And it's all right for them to do it. It's easy for them to do it. In normal circumstances, you would not do such a thing. You would not behave like that. But because that has become a culture of the people, the culture allows you to do that. So culture plays a very major role in making things that are difficult, things that are hard, things that are challenging, simple for us and easy for us to do. The same thing is with perception, how we perceive things. We see, an example I can give you is, for example, people, when they like something, when they see it to be good for them, they would spend a lot of money to enjoy that thing, to make use of that thing. For example, you know, there are people who would spend big bucks to go to a football game. And knowing that it is difficult, it's not easy to go to a football game. You have to park, you know, far away, you have to walk, then you have to pay an extreme amount of money for the seat. And then you have to pay big bucks for the food and the drinks inside and the vendors. And then you buy all these flags and, you know, these type of things that you buy there. And then you have to sit through the game 3 hours, and the people around you are drunk, cursing, and you have to listen to their nonsense. And it's cold outside sometimes, sometimes it's raining, and you weather the storm, you sit through the weather and the bad conditions, and you still have fun doing all these things. Why is it? Because you want to do it, because it's exciting for you to do it. But for another person who doesn't like football, even if you paid him to go, he would not go there. Even if you tell him that, listen, I'm going to give you big bucks to go and sit there, he'll say, no, I won't do it. Right? Because to him it's torture. Right? For some people, the same thing is torture, while for some people, the same thing is pleasure. So, is it good or bad? Well, that depends on how you look at it. If you like it, then it's going to be pleasurable for you. If you don't like it, it's going to be torture for you. So you see, when your perception changes to of anything, changes to the extent that you start liking it, then it means that you would go through hardships to enjoy the things that you like. And it might, obviously it's not liked by everyone. I mean, there are many people who don't like it, and there are many people who like it. So the issue is that when you perceive something to be good, you would go through difficulties, and the difficulties you go through become easy on you. So two things are necessary here that we see. One is culture, the other is perception. If these two things, if you make anything a part of these two things, you will see that that thing will become easy for us to do. That thing will become easy for us to do. So now when we look at religion, when we come to deen, and we see that in deen, what is hard about religion? What is difficult about religion? We have to be honest. I mean, ideology is not hard or difficult. That's why everyone believes or claims to believe. No one denies their belief. Everyone says, yes, I believe in Allah, I love Ahlul Bayt. That's the easy part. What is the difficult part about religion? What is the hard part about deen? The difficult part about religion is obligations. That's what's difficult. A difficult part about deen is prayer, fasting, homes, hajj, zakat. These things are difficult because they're obligations, they're a burden. Now, when we look at that and when we see that, well, why are they difficult for us? And they are difficult. I mean, you know, it's a lie to say they're not. It's wrong to say that, oh, you know what, oh, no, actually these things are fun for us. No, they're not fun. Right? They're not enjoyable also. They are difficult, they are dry, and they're boring. They're redundant, and we do it every day. Now, the issue is, how do we make it easy for us to do these things? Because a lot of times when we look at prayer, prayer is not about enjoyment. It's an obligation that we have to do. And we're doing it because Allah said so. It's not an enjoyment. Anyone who says that, oh, I enjoy praying, and it's enjoyable for me, and, you know, I find it pleasing and pleasurable, is not saying the truth. No, prayer is difficult. Prayer is hard. It's meant to be hard. It's meant to be difficult. Right? Otherwise, if it was easy, if it was enjoyable, it wouldn't be an obligation then. See, Allah kept all the exciting things, Allah made them mustahab, not wajib. He made them mustahab. You know, like you go, for example, ziyarat. Right? Ziyarat is easy. You know, when you compare it to hajj, hajj is an obligation, right? Where we have to run around, do things exactly on time, doing these things, and hence it's difficult. Ziyarat, there's nothing wajib in ziyarat. So you go there, you take your time, you go to the haram. When you want to go to the haram, you can do what you want to do there. No one is pressuring you to do anything at a certain time. There's no pressure on you because it's not wajib. There's nothing wajib there. So mustahab things, Allah made things that are exciting, mustahab. He didn't make them wajib. Wajib things are difficult. So when we want to tell our children and teach them about prayer, as a note, and I'm just, as an advice I'm saying to you, do not tell a lie about prayers. The worst thing that we can do is lie to our children about prayer or fasting or any of these obligations. A child asks his dad, why do you pray? And the dad lies to the child, "Oh, I love prayers. It's enjoyable for me. It's a pleasure praying." And the son tries to find the pleasure in it. When he couldn't, he gets frustrated, and then he despises the fact that he's unable to find the pleasure in it. Why did you lie to your child? You should say the truth. When your child says, "It's hard for me to pray," you should tell them, "It's hard for me also. It's hard for me also. I do it because Allah told me to. That's why I do it." We don't pray to enjoy prayers. To try to find enjoyment in prayer is our biggest mistake. That's why people are frustrated with prayer, that they can never find that pleasure that is being talked about by people who don't know what prayer is about. Prayer is not about enjoying prayers. You don't pray because you enjoy it. You pray because Allah told you to. You pray because Allah told you to. We don't pray because we want to enjoy prayer at our level. Yes, when you look at the imams, when you look at them and how they prayed, it's different, right? You know, don't look at them and their prayer and try to compare it to our level. Our level is, listen, I do it because Allah told me to, and that's it. So our level, at our level of people that we are, of mu'mineen that you all are, our level for prayer is to pray not to enjoy it, but to let prayer discipline us and make us a person, make us better. Let the prayer make us better. You don't pray to enjoy prayers. You pray like Allah told you to pray, and let Allah enjoy your prayer. Your job is just to pray and let Allah see you and enjoy you praying. That's why we pray. "Allah, I'm doing it because you told me to. You watch me and you see how I'm doing." This is why we pray. So we shouldn't be lying about prayers. No, the fact that we pray is why? Because of the fact that Allah told us to pray. Obligations are difficult. Now, Allah made our life difficult. Certain things difficult in our life for what? For what reason? Let me expand on that. If you stand at salawats. You know, there are many things in life that we do that are difficult. And we do it. And we do it every day. And Allah made those things in us as a need that we have to do it. There are things that we do in our life that are so disgusting that we don't even want to talk about it with others. And every day we do it. We do dirty things every day that we don't even want to talk about, and we need to do it. Right? I mean, you know, we all have experience of doing dirty things that you wouldn't come out and give a commentary of that to others. Right? Allah made insan like all other animals. Allah made them have the need to eat. We eat. And then when you eat, that has to go out somewhere. And like all animals, we need to defecate. And we do it every day. Now no one comes out and gives a commentary of, "Hey, listen, this is what happened." Even though I heard from European brothers, right, that Americans do have a habit of doing a commentary of everything they do, right? But the fact is that we do these things every day as a need. Allah put it as a need in us to do these things. And we do it every day. And Allah has made these things necessary in our being. Have you ever thought why? I mean, Allah, who is the creator, could have created us in such a way that there was no need to do this. He could have done that. But he wanted us to do this. Have you ever thought that why was there a need to go to the bathroom? Why did Allah made us like that? But if I understand the wisdom in Allah's creation, that Allah is making us do these difficult, sometimes disgusting things, and as a need we do them, so that whenever we have a question about Allah's deen and His obligations, that these are difficult, then Allah is saying to us, there are many more difficult things, much more difficult things you do in your life, and if you compare them to 2 rakat of prayer, you will see that that is much more difficult than this. So if you're doing that every day, there shouldn't be any excuse for you to make a 2 rakat prayer. Understand this. How Allah is making us, in our own needs, making us realize that prayer or obligations, even though it is difficult, but it's not more difficult than other things that we are doing in life. And Allah is saying that, why are you complaining about this? Why are you complaining about this when you're already doing things that are difficult, much more difficult than this? The only reason why this happened, Allah is trying to make us realize this. What does Allah have to do to make us realize that obligations are not that difficult? Really? What does Allah have to do? Allah is saying that, listen, the problem is not in obligation. The problem is that you haven't made obligation a part of your culture yet. You haven't made these obligations a part of your culture. Once they become a part of your culture, then many other things that you do in life, so many things that you do in life that are difficult and hard and challenging, and you do it with such ease, you will see that this will also become easy for you. If you only make it a part of your culture. A person comes to me and he told me, not just one time, but many youngsters, you know. They said that, you know, Maulana, I like to listen to music because it's relaxing. I like listening to music because it's relaxing. My question to him is not about haram and halal. You know, my question to him is that, what did you do to yourself to like music? What have you done to yourself that you actually like it? Imam Ali said that, like, music is the wailing of shaitan. What did you do to yourself that you like the wailing of shaitan? That's the real question. What have you done to yourself? You know, there's something that you have done to yourself that you actually like this. When you speak about music, for example, what does music do? And this is just a side point. Just want to mention this and go on with the rest of the speech, you know. What is this music? What does it do? Very simple, my friend. You see, what music does is that it makes us do things that are illogical and irrational. That's what it does. It makes us do things that are irrational and illogical, things that we wouldn't do normally. You know, have you ever watched people dancing? Is that a yes or no? Anywhere, on TV. Well, if you have watched people dancing, if you watch people doing this, right, it's, you know, they're dancing because the music is going on. If you turn the music off, will they keep on dancing? Then you ask them, go on dancing, you're doing a good job, come on, go on. I can't. So why not? We need the music. He says, you don't need the music to dance, you can dance without the music. But you look dumb if you do that. So, you need music to do things that you normally would not do in a rational mindset. You see, that's what music does. It makes you do things that you would not do normally. It dumbs your mind to do things that you would not do normally. But you see, people, they like it. And they have done something to themselves to like this. If we can get that idea and our perception and our culture to like the obligations that Allah has given us, then you will see that these obligations would not be difficult for us to do. It would become easy for us. The only reason obligations are not easy for us to do is because of the fact that they're not a part of our culture, nor our perception about them is correct. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, if we make these obligations a part of our culture, that's the first thing we need to do. Because obligations right now, when we look at the way in which Shias are operating and they have been living their lives, you see that most of us have not made the obligations that Allah gave us, the burdens that Allah gave us, the taklif that Allah gave us, a part of our culture. It's something that we do on the side, you know, and there's burden in it for us to do it. It hasn't become our culture yet. Yeah, our perception about it hasn't become correct yet. Now let's be just give some examples, because here when we live in this society that makes us defy authority and wants us not to listen to superiors, and they instill these ideas in us that, listen, you are your own person. And everyone is proud to say that, I am my own man and I do what I want to do. I do what I wish to do. And this idea that is given to us, and many of us live our lives according to that principle, that I do what I want to do, what I desire to do. One thing, I will just mention it today and I'll explain it tomorrow, is this, my friends, that anyone who says that he is living his life according to his own desire, then in his life, he hasn't found happiness yet. Anyone who claims that living your life according to what you want is better than living your life according to a superior authority is lying. Anyone who says that I'm happier living my life according to my own will is lying. It is not the truth. Because happiness is gained by listening to a superior authority, by listening to the orders of someone who's above you. There is a pleasure in it. There's a pleasure in it, and as I said, I will explain this tomorrow, what is this pleasure, where it comes from. But right now, just understand this statement of mine, just know what I'm saying right now, and then, inshallah, you know, because for us to have the correct understanding of obligation is very important, because when we don't have the correct obligation, we will always be struggling in trying to do them. In trying to do them, you see, you're always struggling and say, why am I not happy by doing this? Why am I not feeling that vibe or that pleasure by doing this? And you always feel that struggle within yourself, and you never reach that point where you will be satisfied, and hence at the end you become frustrated with this and start losing your grip on your religion. And then everyone says that, you know, how can we become, you know, I mean, how can we enjoy our obligations or our prayers or fasting? This is why it's very important for us to have a correct understanding of this. And the fact is that obligations are difficult. They're not easy. And obligations, in order for us to make it easy, they need to become a part of our culture. And obligations that we see are what we are burdened by the command of someone who's superior to us. What it means is that we are listening to someone who's above us. Listening to someone who's above us is what gives us pleasure in this life. My friends, dunya and things of dunya are inherently boring. Any anything in this world, and I want you to see this. What is the best food that you like? Pizza? Burgers? Biryani? Whatever food you like. What is the best food that you like? And you say that, you know what? I can live off this. I can live off this. I mean, if I only have this to eat, and then that's it, you know, I'll be good. Whatever it is that you like all the time, you know? What is the best food you like? Whatever it is, let me give that to you for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for at least a month. Maybe less. And I want to see how fast you get tired of it. This is the best food you like. But if you eat it all the time, you see, you get tired of it. You can't go on eating it. You say, listen, enough. Give me something else. So in order for dunya to become exciting, you need variety. Dunya itself is boring. That's why you need variety in order to enjoy it. You need that variety. That's why Allah made things here in variety so that we don't get bored of just eating one thing. And he said, I gave you the onions and this and that, this and that. He told that to an Israel. That I gave you all these things, a variety of things to eat, so that you don't get bored of just eating one thing. Even though they're happy with bagels. But still Allah gave all these different things, right? So that dunya doesn't become boring. Because dunya in itself inherently is boring. It is something that's dry. And we can't enjoy it. In order for us to enjoy it, we need to have that variety. This is what dunya is. And we are all looking for a way that we can tolerate this dunya. We're all looking for a way of how we can put up with this dunya. That's all human beings are doing. How can we put up with this for the life that we are living? See, all the talk about enjoyment and happiness, this and that, this is just illusions. What mankind is trying to do is to find a way to put up with dunya. How do we put up with dunya? Some people find relief in alcohol and drinking wine and getting drunk. Some people find other sort of escapism and look for something else. We believers are doing the same thing. We're also trying to find a way how we can put up with this dunya. The only thing is that we also have an intoxicant. The difference is that they find their intoxicant and escape in alcohol and beer and wine. We find our intoxicant and escape in the love of Ahlul Bayt. Love of Ahlul Bayt is what makes us put up with this dunya. It's what makes us put up with this. We're doing the same thing. Because dunya itself is something that's boring. That's why, you see, Jannat is something else. Inshallah, yeah, like one of these days I'll speak about Jannat. Right? But dunya itself inherently is boring. And in order to enjoy it, you need a variety. That's why we need Ahlul Bayt to put up with this dunya. That's why we are in love with Ahlul Bayt. It helps us to live our life away here. Only a few years we're living here. If Akhirat was like dunya, imagine living in eternity here. I mean, in 80 years people are sick and tired of dunya. 80 years. Now just imagine eternity here. You know, what would you do here? See, this is what we are doing here. Understand what life is here. Now, these obligations that Allah gave us is what gives us pleasure here. This is what gives us pleasure here. If you want to find true pleasure, a person cannot find pleasure unless he is obligated. Unless he has someone telling him what to do. You see, there's a pleasure in that. Yes. The opposite, the flip side is also true. What is the flip side? The flip side is that if your life is just obligation and nothing else, yes, that's a difficult life. If you're just obligated to do things, do this, and all you do is just do what others tell you and you don't do anything yourself or what you desire, that also is suffocating. That's also true. But the fact remains that living a life under obligation is better than living a life without obligation. You see, the spirit of a person who has work and a person who doesn't have work. You see, a person who's working, you see, he has life in him, that he is doing something, he has a job, he has an obligation. He's under obligation. A person who is unemployed, you see, it's very difficult for him to live away his days. It's difficult for him. Why is this difference in this spirit between these two people? It's because a person who's under obligation, there's a pleasure in being under, being obliged, being under the obligation of someone else. Especially Allah's obligation, my friends. There is that pleasure in there. And that's what we need to realize. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. This obligation that Allah put us under, these wajibat that we have, if we understand the pleasure that we get from these wajibat, then you see, you understand that, for example, for those people who have been to Hajj, you will understand it because you have been there. Those who haven't, inshallah, may Allah take you there, so you have a better understanding of what I'm saying. When a person goes for Hajj, you see, Hajj is a constant list of obligations. You know, wajib things, haram things. You have to do this, you can't do this. And every moment, every step of the way, you're being told to do something, or you're being told to avoid something. And like people are like, oh, it's so difficult, and they're trying to make sure that they do the right thing, make sure they don't do the wrong thing, and they're, you know, very careful in what they do. Now after they go through Hajj, all that difficulty, then it's over. When the Hajj is over, you know, now they're sad. Oh, I want to come back here again. So what do you want to come back here again for? I mean, isn't it enough? I mean, look at it. You're always under obligations here. Do this, don't do that, don't do this. You know, now you're free. You can go back and do what you want. He said, no, there's a sadness of leaving that state of being under the obligation of a superior authority. That you want to go back there. You see? There's that sadness. This is why you see that there's a pleasure when we are under the obligation. You have something to do. Yes, Allah is telling me, I have a boss. I have someone. I have a master. Right, I'm not unemployed. I'm not, you know, nobody. I'm someone. My friends, this is that a glance at that pleasure. And even though it's difficult, even though it's hard, even though it's challenging, but when you look at it, you will see that it is made easy for us by when someone practices, when someone does these obligations with that fervor and that love and that pleasure. You know, why aren't we able to make our children do their obligations? It's because when they see us doing our obligations, they don't find us having that keenness to do it. You know, I remember in the days that Imam Khomeini was alive, and watching a film about him, and that he was in the hospital making prayer, and watching the keenness and that fervor that he had in making that prayer, that, you know, told me and the likes of me, that had more impression of prayers on me than any book that's written on prayers. Just watching someone pray with that keenness. You know, when you do something with, you know, like a liking, you see, others are also looking at it, what do you get out of it? I want to feel the same thing you're feeling. But when you don't feel anything, And you're like, you know, man, I need to do this. All right. Oh, yes, you know, Islam makes me do this. You know, then what happens is that other people can say, man, I'm glad I'm not following what you follow. You know, no burdens here. No, the fact is that when you have that keenness, when you see someone with so much fervor and so much enthusiasm when they do something, then you look at them and say that, wow, I want to see what they're feeling. How did the Arabs of Jahiliyyah, who were so ignorant and arrogant that they had no clue of what is right and wrong, people who were completely absurd and had no value for law or life, how did these people become such that they would not leave prayers no matter what happened? See, imagine this, my friend. Imagine the impression that the likes of Rasulullah left on them. The enthusiasm that he prayed with was able to change a nation of people who had no value for law or life. See, that is, when you look at a person like that, then you're like, wow, I want to feel the same thing he's feeling. I want to know what he's knowing at the time he prays. You know, this is, my friends, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, you know, after Karbala, for 35 years, cried so much, that the people who are close to him, people who would come anywhere close to him would get that, it would rub off on them. And they would also feel the mourning. They would also feel the loss that he is facing. And he made crying a part of people's culture just by crying so much. That happened. I've seen it happen myself. And really, you know, when we were working on people, you know, trying to convert them to Islam and, you know, doing Dawah and all these things, people were coming into Shia Islam and becoming Shia. They would come to majlises, they would listen to the speeches, you know, and the question was that, yeah, I mean, how would they get that, you know, that emotion to cry? Right. I mean, for us, we take it for granted, you know, all our lives. We have grew up in this environment where people are crying. We oversaw elders crying. And hence, we know that, well, this is the time that we look down and, you know, we start becoming grieved at the speech. You know, the Masaib are coming, and that's where you know that, you know, I mean, you need to be feeling sad right now because you have seen it happen over and over again. It has become a part of us. Or how about these people who have never been a part of that, and they just came in, how would they learn how to cry? How would they have that emotional attachment to Ahlul Bayt? One thing is logical attachment, rational attachment, that's easy to attain. Yes, Imam Ali is haq, he is right, you know, and these are the proofs for it. Granted, they understood that. You know, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, they're all right. That's there. But how do you gain that emotional attachment where you actually cry when you listen to what Imam Hussein went through? You know? And I saw that one person in our center, whenever the Masaib used to be there, he would just cry. I mean, yeah, you have certain people, you know, who would say that whenever the Masaib happens, you see they go off right away, start crying. You know, and they would be the loudest one, and that's it, they are crying. It's in that. Right? And you had one sincere brother who would just, you know, anytime he heard about Imam Hussein, he would just cry. Just cry. Right? And when the Messiah would start, that's it, he would cry. He wouldn't care who's around him this night, he would just cry. And he used to cry all the time in the center. Whenever the majlis goes on, he would cry. The American brothers would look at him, And then you know what? They also started putting their heads down. And they also started to shed tears. And slowly, the crying became a part of their lives also. When I looked at that experience, then I said that, you know what, if these 5-6 brothers have learned crying from one person, imagine all of Shias have learned crying from Imam Sajjad. You know, this is how it happens, my friends. When you actually feel for something, when you understand something to that extent, then you see that it has an effect on others. It has an effect on others. Imam Sajjad's crying, every time you used to see Imam Sajjad, whenever he used to see anything that reminds him of Karbala, he would cry and remind people of Imam Hussein. Every time he would do that. When someone used to bring a glass of water in front of him, he would cry. He would cry. He said, "Ah, this glass of water. This glass of water." He would see it and he would cry. Why would he cry? He said, "My father was slaughtered without being given water. Even animals are given water." You know, we hear these things and sometimes it becomes, you know, redundant for us. You know, when we say that Imam Hussein was killed without water being given to him, you know, just let me give you an example so it becomes more closer to you and your mind gets closer to what I'm saying. You know, this incident was from Europe, a city in Europe where there was an Iranian center, and on Ashura they were having the Ashura rituals. And one of the rituals that they were having is that they were going to slaughter a sheep. While everyone is there, they were going to slaughter a sheep. And this, you know, obviously, you know, it was in the center, outside the center, in the lot outside. And the neighbors got wind of this, that this is happening. And it came in the news that they were going to slaughter a sheep in front of others. And then the Humane Society got involved and they said that, listen, we will not allow you to slaughter a sheep in front of others. Right? Other people are watching it, and this is inhumane to do that. This is against animals' rights to do that in such a way. Imagine this, that even for animals, people are worried about the fact that, listen, you want to slaughter it, go in the slaughterhouse and slaughter it. Don't slaughter it in front of people. But when we see that Imam Hussein was slaughtered in front of everyone, everyone was watching him being slaughtered, and no water is given to Imam Hussein, there's no one in this whole nation that would come forward and say, this is the grandson of Rasulullah that you are slaughtering him, that you're cutting his neck. This is the grandson of Rasulullah that you're doing this to him. At least do it somewhere else. Don't do it in front of others. But you see, even that they had no regard for. Imam Hussein was slaughtered in front of everyone. It was a spectacle for everyone to watch as Rasulullah, as the Prophet's grandson, was slaughtered there. This is how Imam Hussein was slaughtered. When Imam Sajjad is crying, there's a reason why he's crying for Imam Hussein. Every time he would walk past, every time he used to walk past a butcher shop, the butchers would close down their shop, because every time Imam Sajjad would see a sheep that is slaughtered, it would remind him of Imam Hussein. His mind would go back to Karbala and it would remind him of Imam Hussein, and he would cry. And once he starts crying, he would stop crying. Imam Sajjad went on crying for 35 years. Until everyone around him and everyone close to him and anyone who got close to him got used to crying for Imam Hussein. The whole nation learned how to mourn for Hussein by one Imam mourning for Imam Hussein. This is how much Imam Sajjad cried for Imam Hussein, and for, well, the reason for him crying. How many reasons can there be?
There cannot be a count on the reason why he is crying for Imam Hussein, because Imam Hussein was lonely. No one was there to help him. You know, Imam Hussein was so lonely in Karbala. Was so lonely in Karbala. Let me just mention to you two reasons. Two things in Karbala and Ashura that happened. One reason is this, that showed how lonely Imam Hussein was. When Shimr came forward to slaughter Imam Hussein, you know what he was doing? He was taking his sword and he was hitting the sword on the ground as he walked towards Imam Hussein. He was hitting it on the ground as he walked towards Imam Hussein. You see, usually when you slaughter an animal, you make the sword sharper so you can cut through faster, and the animal, he doesn't feel that much pain. And you are able to cut through it right away. But you see, he was hitting the sword on the ground as he walked towards Imam Hussein. And they asked him, Shimr, why are you hitting the sword on the ground? He says, I want to bow the sword because I want to show all of you that Hussein has no helpers and I will take my time slaughtering him. I'll take my time cutting his head. Watch me as I cut his head. This is the first thing. And the second thing, you know what showed him how lonely Imam Hussein was? That when everyone was killed and the tents were plundered and they were burnt to the ground and the bodies of the martyrs lay on the battlefield, then Umar ibn Sa'd gave an order that, listen, get all the bodies together and trample them. Trample them with the hooves of the horses. Take the horses and run them over. Now this in the Arab world was the ultimate insult to anyone. If any tribesman was put through this, then the whole tribe was put to shame. So now when Umar ibn Sa'd gave that order, the tribe of Hur came forward and said, listen, you killed Hur, that's fine, but listen, do not do this trampling on Hur's body. If you do it, then the whole tribe will rise against you. So you know, Umar ibn Sa'd said, alright, you can take his body away, we don't need his body. They took his body away. Then Habib ibn Mazahir's people came forward. They said, you cannot trample Habib's body. Then Umar ibn Sa'd said, okay, you can take his body away. You can take his body away also. And as each of the companions, tribesmen came forward and they claimed the body of their tribesmen who died with Imam Hussein, they would not let his body be trampled. Even the children and the relatives of Imam Hussein, their bodies were claimed by their tribesmen. You see, even Ali Akbar's body was claimed by his mother's side. Abbas's body was claimed by his mother's side. Everyone's body was claimed. The only body that wasn't claimed on Ashura was the body of Imam Hussein. In the whole nation of the Muslim world, not one Muslim is there who is going to come forward and claim the grandson of Rasulullah, and that he's going to say, do not trample him. If you trample him, we will fight with you. Imam Hussein was the only one who was trampled on Ashura. سيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون يا محمود بحق محمد يا علي بحق يا فاطر السماوات بحق فاطمة يا محسن بحق يا حسن يا قدم الأسان بحق يا سيد الله give us the tawfiq to be on the right path give us the wisdom to understand your guidance hasten the reappearance of our imam make us his helper when he comes واخر الدعوان الحمد لله رب العالمين يا حسين